everyone. My name's Haley. I'm a super crazy, grateful member of Al-Anon. A few thanks. First of all, I'm going to time myself tonight just so I can kind of keep track of where I'm at. Thank you to the Sunday Night Martinez meeting for inviting me to share my story tonight. If you're in need of a really awesome small meeting, there's a lot of love, there's a lot of heart in that room, and I really love that Sunday night meeting in Martinez. Thank you to Kim S. for inviting me back. There's a semi-funny story about me being invited back. This is actually my second time sharing at this meeting. And so tonight is a little bit of an amends for me because I'm petrified of public speaking. And I forgot to ask. Can everybody? Okay, everybody can hear me. I'm petrified of public speaking. And the first time I came here to share was over the summer. I think I made it about halfway through. So tonight, hopefully I'll do more than halfway. And thank you so much for believing in me, Kim, when sometimes I don't always believe in myself. It means a lot. And believing that I have something to share. I appreciate it. So a little bit about me. I was born in Texas, proud Texan, to a single mom. I was raised an only child. My mom also raised an only child, though she had a lot of siblings. She was actually adopted as a baby, and she was adopted by a beautiful couple. My grandparents were, in my opinion, could do no wrong. But my grandmother was an alcoholic. Took me many years to understand that my grandmother's alcoholism actually affected me too. I don't think I really learned that until I got into these rooms. Rather, my first recollection of alcohol and alcoholism came from my stepdad. And my mom met my stepdad when he came in the picture when I was about 5 years old. excuse me, I'm still getting over that nasty bug that's going around. My stepdad was the kind of drinker that you never really knew what you were going to get. So that sometimes he was the life of the party, and more often than 50% of the time, that life of the party and the fun and games would switch to sheer terror in like 2 hot seconds, and anything could set him off. So it might be me responding with what instead of sir, how I had been taught. When my dad called me, I was supposed to say sir. It might be my mom cooked a dinner that my dad didn't like. It might be the cat jumping on my dad's lap and accidentally putting the claws in his leg. And when my dad got angry, oftentimes somebody got hurt. So that could be the dog, that could be the cat, that could be my mom, and that might be me. So as I was growing up, I really learned to be small, to really, as small as I could be, as much time as I could spend in my bedroom, as much time as I could spend away from home, the better. I was out of the line of fire, so to speak. Now, my parents on the outside were the beautiful couple. I remember my friends, all of my friends would say, wow, your mom is so beautiful and your dad is so handsome and they're so successful. And that was all probably true. My dad had a good job. My story is not one of not having enough food on the table. But there were a lot of secrets going on in my house. And they had that image to protect. We moved around a lot. So I told you I started in Texas. Between my parents meeting and me landing here in the Bay Area, which I landed in the Bay Area when I was about 10, we moved from Texas to Denver, Colorado, to Vancouver, British Columbia, to Seattle, Washington, to here, right here, as a matter of fact, in Walnut Creek, California, when my dad got a great job here. And that was about 10 years old. by the time we got here, we were really going to try to become that family unit. And again, that idea of the family secrets were really being instilled in me so that when I was a teenager, about 13 years old, I started to get very angry. And what that looked like on the outside is that I might be sneaking into the bottles of alcohol and watering those down. I might be sneaking cigarettes behind Safeway or at school, or, you know, maybe smoking pot or experimenting with things. Like I had, you know, by the time I was a teenager, I started to fill a hole inside of me, and I really felt like an outsider. So anything I could do to try to fill that hole or to try to make me feel like I belonged somewhere, I tried, quite honestly. So at about 13, my parents decided that it was time for me to go to a therapist. And I'll never forget on the way to the therapist. This was a family therapist. It was somebody we were going to sit down with, all three of us. And on the way to the family therapist, my parents giving me a list of things that we were not going to talk about at the family therapist. So, you know, that was very clear to me, the rules. And again, breaking the rules literally meant that I might be hurt. So I tried to follow the rules. The result for me, what I took to adulthood was, you know, again, that sense of smallness. It was a defining moment as a child, as a teenager for me. You know, my dad, I told you he had a good job in San Francisco. I haven't mentioned he had been married previously. So I had a stepbrother and a stepsister. So they were in college at the time. So my dad was supporting two families, his first family and then our family here in the Bay Area. So my parents shared a car, and my mom would take my dad to BART every day. And sometimes my dad would show up on the BART train on the way home, and sometimes my dad wouldn't show up on the BART train on the way home. And my mom, like every good untreated Al-Anon, when, you know, this is long before cell phones, if he hadn't called, she would be there waiting for him at the said time. And if he didn't show up, she would go back and wait at the very last BART train to assure he was going to arrive. And some nights he did, and some nights he didn't. There were a lot of indiscretions on my dad's part in their marriage. And as a teenage girl, there's nothing worse than seeing your mom cry. So I remember very succinctly one night, she went to the BART train to pick him up, and he wasn't there. And, you know, she came home in tears. And I don't remember when the last BART train was, 11 o'clock midnight. And I remember her crying, and I said, "Let's leave. This is such a great opportunity. We can get the hell out of here." And her looking at me and saying, "I don't know how I would take care of you, Haley. What about college? How am I going to put food on the table?" And my response was, "We'll be fine. I'll get a job." I think I was like 14 years old. You know, I'm like, "I'll quit school. I'll get a job. My grandparents will help us. Whatever it is I need to do." And my mom really saying no. And I felt like my mom was a coward. That's kind of what I took away from it. But also what I took away from it is I made a decision at that moment that I would never, ever, ever rely on somebody to take care of me, that I would always be able to take care of myself. And that's what I carried to adulthood. There was physical abuse when I was growing up. As I told you, you never knew what could happen. Unfortunately, there were a few times where my dad would come and try to crawl in my bedroom as a kid. So there was sexual abuse when I was growing up. And I think emotionally, that's just sort of par for the course with all of the other things that were going on. So my parents continued being very worldly and moving around. My dad got it was the same job, but he got transferred to Australia when I was about 17, so still in high school for me. And they asked me if I wanted to go, and I'm like, "Thank you very much, I'll stay here." And I did. So I got an apartment. I finished high school here, Northgate High School, actually, here in Walnut Creek. I took that fierce independence that I told you about to my adult life. And it worked for me professionally in a lot of good ways. I mean, we hear in these rooms now that a lot of those character assets eventually turn into defects. And when I was thinking about what to share tonight, I really was like, that's just such a key defining moment for me because, and you know, Marilyn, you read that adult child thing tonight, and I think I must have been so nervous the last time that it went right over my head, because I've never heard that. And it's so moving. I very much wanted to be in control. And, you know, I fortunately, probably something that saved my life, I had a job that I loved. I ended up working in the music business. It was a fun job. And I soared in my career, and I worked my way up the career ladder. And that really was where I was able to fill that hole that was inside of me, with work, or at least try to fill that hole. I think it worked for a little while. Now my personal relationships, completely different story. That was not working out so well. I kept a pretty tight grip on my heart. In fact, I think I built a wall around my heart. And that doesn't mean that I didn't have relationships. I did. But I don't think I ever truly let anybody in. My self-will was very, very strong. With my job, I got to live in a lot of America's greatest cities. I moved around a lot. Every time, I think, coming back to the Bay Area, I love it here. But I moved to Seattle, tried that geographic change. I moved to LA, I moved to San Diego, I've lived in Austin, Texas, and each time after all those moves, I would come back here. This time I decided I'm not leaving, by the way. I don't want to leave anymore. you know, what finally brought me to Al-Anon was that I'm in my second marriage, by the way. In my late 30s, excuse me, I had gum in my mouth and I need to get rid of that. In my late 30s, I had decided still trying to fill that void and that hole inside of me, I wanted to have a family. And I was sure that having kids would fix my problems. And that had always been a dream for me. So when I made that decision, I ended the relationship I was currently in because he didn't want to have kids, and connected with somebody else within a couple of weeks, which was a common theme in my life. I remember our first date, I said, "We can't even go on this date unless you want kids, dude." You know, he was living in New York, I was living here in the Bay Area. Somehow, within a couple of years, we both ended up with jobs in San Diego, which is where we got married. You know, I did know enough at that time and had seen enough therapists. By the way, I'd gone to therapy from 13 all the way till this point, my late 30s, to at least check. He wasn't an alcoholic. I thought I was okay. What I didn't know was he had been married before and had two kids, and he had a son that was an addict. And by the time we got married, his son was living with us. His son was addicted to benzodiazepines. And about a week before we got married, he came to me and said, "You know, I've changed my mind. I don't want to have kids." That was really, really, really crushing for me. But I married him anyway. I didn't know that I had choices. I just added it to the victim list. You know, I had a very long list of ways that I had been victimized, and I felt like I wasn't worthy, and, you know, maybe that was God's way of punishing me for all the wrongs that I had done, or, you know, I just wasn't worthy somehow. So that just went on that list and just helped build that hole that was, you know, inside of me. But like I said, I married him anyway, my part. I learned much later. But I was the queen of silent scorn in my marriage. I didn't necessarily talk to my husband about that. Except when we got in really big fights, which wasn't very often. And then it might come out that he stole my dreams and he was a complete asshole, or, you know, whatever other fine words I could find. My husband was not great at keeping a job. So, you know, my own best thinking had got me where I was. We worked in the same industry, and I was kind of a big shot at a company in San Diego. And as he was losing his job in San Diego, my own best thinking, I happened to have an opening where I worked. And yes, I did. That would solve all our problems, right? At least he would keep a job and we could pay the mortgage. So You know, again, adding to that very long list. Now I'm angry and bitter. I have no family. I have my husband working for me, and that definitely did not work out well. And even in my better judgment, it wasn't long after that that my stepson was working for me too. So yeah, proud moment. When I realized how deep of shit I had got myself into, I didn't know what else to do but to quit my job and leave. And I did. I really didn't. You know, I mean, I think that's what we might call a geographical change. That's when I moved to Austin. And my husband and I made an agreement that his son, my stepson, wasn't going to come. And we knew a little bit. We had never come to Al-Anon, but we knew a little bit that it wasn't helping him. That was very clear because, by the way, I guess I haven't mentioned this, my stepson had moved on from benzodiazepines to heroin by this point. So in Austin, my husband never got a job. So I was the sole provider. And one day I came home from work and my stepson was on the couch. And I'm like, hey, how are you? How long are you here? And he said, my dad bought me a one-way ticket. Ah, hallelujah. Again, silent scorn. I just was really, really angry. And I didn't know how to have a healthy conversation. And I really didn't trust myself to make good decisions. I mean, that's something else that I had added to this list that I had going, by the way. I didn't trust anybody else, and I certainly didn't trust myself. So I just got really depressed. And I think this was, you know, I'd been depressed. I'd had a very challenging time up till then, but I don't know that I've ever been depressed like I got in Austin. I got to a point where the only reason I could get out of bed was to go to work. And I would come home and lock myself in the bedroom, angry at my husband, angry at myself, angry at the stepson. And I'd lock myself in the bedroom and I would watch. Does anybody know Investigative Discovery? It's like Wives with Knives kind of shows, you know? I don't know why I loved these shows so much. I was like, well, somebody has it worse than me, right? These are really like true crime stories and they are like brutal. And I watched them incessantly for a long time until somehow I found the courage to try a therapist again. You know, it had been a couple of years since I'd tried a therapist. Again, you know, I didn't feel like anything was helping, but I walked into a therapist and I said, I really think I want a divorce, but I want to check myself before I wreck myself. I knew enough to know that I couldn't just leave. Like, I knew that wasn't going to fix it. I knew I had been chasing my tail. Like, I could see that. I just didn't know. I didn't know how to fix it. Thank God this therapist is. She's still my therapist today. She's still in Austin. She's a what we would call a double winner. So she told me I needed to go to Al-Anon. And, you know, I'd heard that before, by the way. I'd been to many therapists. But the idea of going and sharing my story and trying one more thing is like eye roll, really? How many times do I need to tell this stuff? But I was desperate. You know, and we hear that a lot here. Like, if you get desperate enough, you'll make a change. And boy, was I desperate. From the time she told me that, to me actually going into the room, was probably 2 or 3 months. So it still took me a few months to find the courage to walk into an Al-Anon room. And before I found the courage to walk into an Al-Anon room, I actually asked my husband and my stepson to leave. You know, the insanity it was too much, you know, police being called, fist fights in my house. I broken promises, you know, that was really, my story. I had a very long list of broken promises. Those were all the ways I had been wronged. So I asked them to leave and I found my way to an Al-Anon room. And I walked in reluctantly. I didn't want to be in that Al-Anon room. But what I heard there were stories a lot like mine. For the first time ever, I began to feel like I belonged somewhere. I mean, this is after a lifetime of telling myself I didn't belong. I was one of those people that sat in the back of the room, scared shitless, quite honestly, to get in the middle, scared to share. Remember, I still carried that smallness with me and that need for control. It's part of the reason I'm petrified of public speaking. So I sat in the back of these Al-Anon rooms for probably 3 or 4 months until a very beautiful woman in Al-Anon, literally at the beginning of the meeting, came and grabbed me by the hand and pulled me right up front. And she said, "You're not sitting in the back tonight." And I was like, "Are you sure? I like it in the back." She became my first sponsor. I just am so wowed by the love. Like, if you're new here, there's like something about these rooms. I sometimes call it magic juju, but like the love and acceptance that I've never felt before. Other people who've gone through the same things that I've gone through. The anonymity, like if I ever feel like I totally screw up, like last time I shared here, I beat the crap out of myself about how poorly I'd done, which, you know, probably wasn't true anyway, but the idea that you'll protect my anonymity, is always sort of with me in my back pocket. And you may notice I keep grabbing this necklace. This is actually an Al-Anon angel, that when I left Austin and came back to the Bay Area, my grand sponsor gave to me. So this little angel is sort of with me and protecting me tonight. So many Al-Anonisms that I love. And some of the things that I heard when I walked into those rooms. One was, feelings aren't facts. Really? That was news to me. I those feelings in a lot of ways had driven me, you know, to do okay in my career. The idea that they weren't real kind of blew my mind. The idea of self-care, it sounds so simple. But by the time I walked into Al-Anon, y'all, I wasn't eating. I wasn't like, if I could get a piece of pizza down, that would be great. I have a sponsor now. I don't know if my sponsor's here tonight. I have a sponsee now who is here tonight. Thank you for being here. I'm very involved and very much in the center of the rooms tonight. And I have so much gratitude for that. My sponsor today always tells me, a salad a day. Have you had your salad today? It's so cute. The idea that I have choices. What? You mean I could have walked away when he said he changed his mind? That never once occurred to me. That meant I couldn't be a victim anymore. Today, those choices, more often than not, and definitely not all the time, progress, not perfection, are for my own well-being. And probably the biggest thing that's changed for me since coming to Al-Anon is a sense of a higher power. You know, I was mad. My parents forced me to go to a lot of church when I was growing up, and I felt like they were such hypocrites. I couldn't understand how, you know, somebody could drag me to church on Sunday mornings and have me go be baptized and then come try to crawl in my bed at night. Sorry, that just did not compute in my head. But what I recognize now is all of those things that I was telling myself, they were just perpetuating that victim place. That's not where I want to be. And letting go and letting God. And when I really start to stress out now, I sometimes will pray and literally just hold my hands up like, God, take this from me. And the idea that I can even say that today blows my mind. I was one of those people, I had to use the group as my higher power for a while. I had to use nature. Nature was my higher power for a while. I struggled with the word God for a long time. But January is a special month. This is 3 years in Al-Anon for me. Yay. Yay. Thank you. I also have a belly button birthday in January. Not that I need any more of those, but both things are true, and both things have sort of brought me full circle. And I'm so honored to be asked to share again tonight. And I have so much gratitude for this program. I write a gratitude journal every day, still with my ladies in Austin. I have been invited to go speak. There's a big women's conference in Austin in April. And they've invited me to come speak at that this year. And, you know, I keep saying I'm so petrified of public speaking, y'all, but I've also learned that my higher power is going to keep giving me things. If things keep showing up, they're there for a reason, and I've learned to listen. So thank you very much for inviting me here tonight. Thank you for being such a warm and welcoming program, and thank you for helping me get to where I am today. I appreciate it. Oh, they're going to make me cry.